So let's start. So last time we ended the lecture with the performance projection and the idea is that by 2020 we reached the exascale category. Okay, so let's calculate it through by using the current top one system, the summit system. And currently we have theoretical peak performance of 200 petaflops, approximately. And with the Linpack benchmark, we reach around 143 petaflops. Okay, so assuming that we get the same efficiency by just scaling up the number of nodes, we need to improve this number by 7x, okay, so that we reach 1004.5 petaflop something, okay, so with a theoretical peak performance of 1400 petaflops. Okay, that means that we need to that the power consumption will be increased by 7 as well. So that means that we are at 86 megawatts, and the specification of Summit is so at full load we get around 91 megawatts. Okay, so the whole facility is specified and designed to or should be specified to draw 91 megawatts of power. So that's quite a lot, actually. So it's not a nuclear power plant yet. Okay, so the output of the smallest nuclear power plant I could find information on is at 5,000 megawatts something. Okay, but still, this is more than some of the low energy countries, so countries that don't need that much energy. So, for example, sub-Saharan countries would take in a year, so if it runs at full speed all the time. And yeah, the number of racks would then be 1,792 compared to 256 racks. Okay, so this means that we would need to have a better network, far better network, huge amount of energy, and the number of cores is increasing rapidly as well. Okay, so we can assume that for the Linpack benchmark, that's probably not a big deal because it's not communication intensive. So it's compute bound. That might not be a problem, but then we would end up with a system that's just designed for matrix-matrix multiplication, which doesn't reflect the applications that should run on such a thing. Okay, so similar picture is with the Taiyo Light, so the number three currently, which would need to be scaled up by a factor of 11. Okay, so since it draws a little bit more power, it needs a little bit more power, but the overall picture is the same. Okay, so moving to exascale, we have the challenges that we need to increase the on-node parallelism. So if we want to stay in the same scale of system size, right? Because we can't house so many racks, right? This doesn't include even storage and all those cooling facilities, etc., right? The idea is that we need to increase the on-node parallelism, well, by a factor of between 7 and 11, right? Taking the current number one system. And of course, we should reduce the power consumption. Okay. The next challenge is, of course, the programmability. Okay. If we increase the on-node parallelism, well, we somehow have to have some tools or programming languages or libraries or whatever to actually deal with that amount of concurrency, right? So if you remember Amdahl's law, right? So whenever we have a serial portion in our code, right, that hurts us significantly, so something needs to be done in that regard, right? And what I forgot to add here is, of course, the challenges regarding the network, right? By increasing the number of nodes, we have to have some solution for the networking as well. Okay, so the supercomputing superpowers, so to say, are currently Japan, China, the United States, and, well, maybe Europe. We'll see. The current plans are that Japan and China are aiming for releasing their first exascale system in 2020, so approximately 1.5 years, right? So probably at the end of 2020, probably to supercomputing 20, right? And the US by 2021, okay? The plan for Europe, it's a little bit difficult, right? We sketched that last time as well. The biggest problem is that Europe doesn't have chip manufacturers, right? Or something like that. So whatever Europe comes up with, they have to rely on some external sources, be it either from Japan or the US, right? So of course you might argue that ARM is still kind of European based. Problem is that they were bought by a Japanese investment firm. Right, so not so European anymore. China is ramping up with their own, hardware designs, and well, the United States, obviously, with Intel and IBM and NVIDIA and AMD. So let's take a look at what Japan has to offer. So Japan is the only nation in this list that actually publicly announced their design, their processor, etc., and their rough idea of what their exascale system might look like, and they named it Post-K computer. Okay, so it should be a successor of the K computer, and I decided not to rewrite the slides, but will show you the slides from Fujitsu. So the Post-K computer will be manufactured by Fujitsu. Okay, NEC would be a competitor to Fujitsu, but they dropped out of the whole process. So Fujitsu is taking over the development of the Post-K supercomputer. They also developed the K supercomputer. Okay, so what's interesting here is that they are using the ARM instruction set architecture. Okay, and for that purpose, they designed a 64-bit ARM chip, which we'll take a look right now. Okay, so the background. Again, so we have their first systems, and eventually the K computer was with the Prime HPC FX100. There was the FX100 was the chip that was installed in the K computer, and now Fujitsu, due to the acquirement of ARM, decided to base their design on the ARM ISA instruction set architecture. They are, this is what the Post-K computer will be based on. Okay, so obviously the goal is high application performance and high and a good power efficiency, right? Good usability. And keeping applications compatible while advancing from predecessors. Okay, so the approaches are to develop scalable and custom CPU cores, right? So in order to get the performance for the computational power, they develop wider SIMD units, and they make use of the high bandwidth memory that's available, right? They try to make it scalable by continue the development of their TOFO interconnect, right? And in addition to that, to reach the power efficiency goal, they incorporated special power measurements and power control functions inside the chips to scale frequency, etc. Okay, so the power horse in the Post-K computer will be the A64FX chip. Okay, so that's the chip, well, the package more or less, and the chip itself contains it's a complete system on chip design. It contains the high bandwidth memory, the interconnect controller, and the different cores, right? So it's a huge chip. I would say it's almost, no, it's not. It's probably at scale at my laptop, but not on the over here. So anyway, it's a real big chip, right? So in order to get the high performance for the computation, they teamed up with the ARM development, and they pushed forward the scalable vector extension. Okay, the scalable vector extension is departing from the traditional SIMD approach in such a way that it's offering real vector instructions. So scalable vector instructions in that sense that you don't have to specify that the instruction doesn't include the actual number of vector elements that you want to process, but that you can set it at runtime. So it's targeting high performance servers by having good performance on floating point calculations, a high memory bandwidth, low power consumption, and scalable performance and configuration, right? So that means that the high bandwidth to calculation, so the bytes per flop ratio, is supposed to go down so that the real apps don't run into the memory bottlenecks. Okay, so and of course they include half precision floating point and partial dot product support for integer arithmetic. Well, obviously for the emerging machine learning applications. Okay, so the key parameters are that per core, in comparison to the Spark 64 chip, the FX100, which was used in the K computer, right? They made a huge jump from 20 nanometer manufacturing to 7 nanometers. The increase of core performance from 34 gigaflops to approximately 57 gigaflops is due to the scalable vector extensions. Okay, they increased the number of cores available, and the number and the total performance number per chip, right? And so this is due to their CMG, which is the scalable architecture to increase the number of cores on the chip, right? And the high bandwidth memory then increases the total bandwidth that you can get from the main memory. And the bytes per flop ratio stays almost constant, even though increasing the actual performance and the number of cores. So that's quite a feature. Okay, so that's more or less a marketing slide where they show off their high calculation throughput, where they are able to show that for 8-bit integer 8-bit partial dot product, they are able to reach 460 giga operations per second. So this is where the what the LINPACK benchmark might achieve, right? And then we decrease the precision of the floating point elements and are able to get more and more performance, right? All right. So the CMG, which stands for Core Memory Group, is the basic building block for the A64, and you have four of those CMGs on the chip, right? Each of those CMGs is associated with one of the high bandwidth memory modules. Okay, they communicate over probably something like a ring bus system, network on chip system, which also includes the where the TOFO controller and the PCI Express controller is also located in, right? So the core memory group consists of 12 compute cores and one additional core that's supposed to do the operating system thingies, right? So like file I/O, etc. They each of them has a dedicated memory controller to the high bandwidth memory. They have a direct connection to the network on chip, a shared level 2 cache, a crossbar connection connecting the 13 cores in this memory group, right? So yeah, that's what it is. So the other interesting thing is what they need is, since it's a 512 bit wide vector instruction set, 512 bit wide vector instruction set, the probability that you end up with data that's spanning more than two cache lines is increasing. So, and for that purpose, they need to sustain 128 bit per cycle read from main memory to feed the SIMD lanes or the vector instruction lanes properly. So that means that from the level one cache, you can actually have unaligned loads, and you have two read ports to properly feed the vector instructions. The other nice thing is that they have what they call combined gather functionality, where you are able to gather different elements from distinct memory regions. Okay, so this is very important for sparse applications. So sparse matrix vector products, for example. All right. The TOFO interconnect controller is integrated into the chip, right? So you have the network on chip on the whole package, and within the package you also have the TOFO network router, and they added two additional lanes to increase the overall bandwidth, and they are able to reach about 0.5 microseconds, so 500 nanoseconds for ping pong latency, probably between two nodes, right? So per hop you have 500 nanoseconds latency, which is quite good, I guess. Right. So the power monitor and power analyzer is also included directly in the chip. So per core you have the energy analyzer, which is able to calculate the power of the entire core, right? You are able to calculate the power of the level 2 cache and the access to the memory, right? This is very helpful. So this is also where the assistant core comes into the game, where you can offload some computation for the power calculation without disturbing the actual computation, the actual scientific computation. You have the power calculation for the interconnect and the PCI Express as well, and all the compute memory groups, core memory groups, have the same energy analysis and power calculation available, right? So that's how you can efficiently monitor the energy, right? So they list some APIs. So in the microsecond latency, or with PAPI, you get a nanosecond latency to analyze the energy, which is quite good, right? They also include the so-called power knobs, where you can not only decrease the frequency, but also decrease the number of decode instructions that that you can issue to the actual dispatching. You can only use certain pipelines, and you can adjust the bandwidth of the high bandwidth memory, right? And in addition to that, you can of course also reduce the frequency, right? So by monitoring and analyzing the actual energy used, you can then react on it and scale down the processor as you need it, right? So for example, if you have a very rough roofline model, then you don't even need a roofline model, right? So if you have a application that doesn't use the main memory as much as it could, the actual power consumption of the HBM2 controller isn't as high as if you fully utilize the main memory, right? So you can adjust the bandwidth without affecting the performance of the application, for example, right? Right, so again, the summary of the chip. So it's based on the ARMv8.2 instruction set, which is the ARM64 or ARCH64 instruction set, and the extension is the scalable vector extension. The SIMD width is at 512 bit, and you have a total of 48 compute cores, with a memory capacity per chip at 32 gigabytes, right, where you have four times the HBM2 memory. Okay, and very nice, you also have a bandwidth of 1,000 gigabytes per second, right? So 1 teraflop per second, that's pretty neat. They seem to reach a pretty good efficiency, where they get a 90% efficiency with the dense general matrix multiplication, and the memory throughput they are able to reach 80% with the stream benchmark. Right. So they are pretty proud of their system. Okay, the system software. What they added essentially to the stack, so the management software and the file system and the programming environment is, well, more or less a standard system. The interesting part is that they added, like all the other systems, their special file I/O layer to be able to have a scalable file system, right, which is directly integrated into the TOFO network. And it supports local temporary file accumulation and doesn't require explicit function calls. So if you have burst buffers, so a burst buffer is a technology where you have special I/O nodes, which with very fast first level storage, you kind of need to have explicit function calls to actually utilize such a burst buffer. Okay. Right. So here's an example where you can where you have multiple levels, or well, two levels. First is the local file system, which is cached and eventually writes to the global Lustre-based file system. So of course, the design is supposed to be very scalable, right? You have one CPU, and one CPU is packed into one CPU memory unit, which is of that size approximately, completely water cooled, right? So you have the water inlets and outlets here. Those are the electrical connectors, and two chips on one of those CPU memory unit. So very, very densely packed. Then you can, or you are able to put eight of those CPU memory units into one bunch of plates, and three of those bunch of plates are then put into a shelf, and eight shelves are then put into one rack, right? So that's the general configuration. So with that configuration, they are able to reach about one petaflop within one rack, okay? Which means that at this configuration, they need approximately 1,000 racks, okay? Which is, so some people doubt or some, so with that in mind, some people think that they have to increase the number of cores on one of the CPUs, right, in order to reduce the number of racks. However, 1,000 racks isn't that big after all, right? You could still build it, and if you consider the size of the K computer, it approximately matches the whole size of it. Okay. Here you see a better picture of the CPU memory unit, right? Where you have those two chips in them. Here you see the electrical connectors, the water inlet, water outlet to actually cool the system. In order to communicate, the TOFO interconnect is based on active optical cables as well as electrical signals. So per CPU memory unit, you have three ports for active optical cables. In order to support the TOFO interconnect network. How the topology in detail looks like, the detail of the topology isn't disclosed yet, so no idea how this might look like. And the performance discussion is, well, they are faster than the predecessor that they had in the K computer, right? So the baseline is here with the Spark 64, then you see the increase of performance in this slide. So overall, they obviously reached their goal. Right, so So by adapting the ARM ISA, the ARM instruction set, and by collaborating with ARM, the idea is that they really work with a proven and strong microarchitecture, and they combine it with HPC system software, right? So, that's the whole idea. So, the goal for the actual release is that that should be released in the second quarter of 2020, right? And they obviously have some prototype systems. We'll see if they are able to reach their goal, right? So so here's where they are. In the second quarter is probably where the manufacturing is supposed to be finished, and then they install it. So you can expect that with the supercomputing conference in 2020, they probably have the first try at the top 500 list, right? And then in 2021, the regular operation begins, right? So, yeah. Eventually we will see more and more information popping up about the system within the year. Okay. So that's the summary of the Post-K computer. So the Post-K computer is the only exascale system or exascale system candidate where we have that much information available, which is a little sad. But still, I can talk about the plans a little bit from the Chinese development. So in total, they have three prototypes in development. Okay. The first one is Tianhe-3, which is also ARM-based. So there is a Chinese company that also developed a 64-core high-performance ARM design, which is supposed to be used in the Tianhe-3 system. The second prototype is next generation Sunway system. So based on the current Taiyu Lite computer, so in the microarchitecture and the processor that they use there. So again, there isn't much information available. And the third prototype will be developed by the company called Sugon, which has the deal, the licensing deal with AMD. So they are aiming at a x86-based system. And their current prototype is ranked, is at position 38 at the moment, right? So this is going to be very interesting. Their goal is to really have similar to the to Japan, to have the at least one of those systems ready by 2020. So next year will be very exciting. I'm not sure why I put 2021 here. Okay. So let's talk about the plans from the United States. So there we have a system which they called Aurora 21. Okay, so the Aurora system was supposed to be delivered at the same time at a summit, and the Sierra system was supposed to be delivered. And the plans was to use the Knights Hill processor design, which is the a Xeon Phi, which was supposed to be the predecessor, the successor of the Knights landing chip. Unfortunately, or fortunately, we will see, the Xeon Phi line was discontinued by Intel, right? And they pushed the release of the Aurora computer back 3 years, with the goal to actually reach the exascale. Okay, so as well as with the Chinese system, there isn't much information available, only rumors so far, but from from the information you can gather on the internet, so regarding the plans by Intel and the talks given by some of the responsible persons at Argonne National Lab, so who are building the Aurora system. It's going to be a novel architecture, which will not be based on the von Neumann architecture. Okay, it's supposed to be drawing 30 to 50 megawatts of power. So that's something they can say already, because they are already building the facility to house the system, and they are designing the whole data center to draw something between power in that ballpark, right? And the idea is to have between 6,000 and 16,000 nodes, so between 100 and 200 racks, depending on how much they can crank up in one system. Okay, so if you search the internet, you will stumble over a patent from Intel that was filed last year, where they are trying to patent something which they call where do I have it? Not here, obviously. Intel's Exascale Dataflow Engine, which is based on the configurable spatial accelerator. Okay, and this is only rumors, but the architecture by itself is very interesting. It's a architecture which looks a little bit like this, and the idea really is that you don't have a continuous instruction stream as you know it with the von Neumann architecture, but the compiler is supposed to. Who has a background in compiler architecture, compiler design? Okay. Anyways, let me try to explain. So if you have a piece of code, what the compiler usually does is something like a data flow analysis. Okay, so how the data flows through the actual system, and the technique that's usually used there is called basic blocks. Okay, that means that when you are at some level in the compilation process, the compiler usually transforms the input program into something that's called single assignment form, static single assignment form. Okay, and with the static single assignment form, you can build basic blocks, and the basic block is essentially something where you have some amount of instructions, usually very small, and there's only one way to get into the to this basic block and one way to get out of this basic block. Or to illustrate it a little bit more, so if you for example have something like an if statement, right? If statement with some condition, then you have a some calculations, right? And so some a plus c equals a plus b, or otherwise else do something else, right? So you would need essentially two basic blocks here, right? Because depending on the condition, you can either jump in here or in here, right? So if you take the surrounding code, right, you and for example, you have a return here and a return here, right? That would mean that if you take this as one block, right, you can exit that block at two points in the instruction stream. So you split that up into two basic blocks, essentially, forming some amount of instructions. Okay, and by having this basic block structure of the original code, you're easily able to derive the actual data flow through the program. And usually those basic blocks aren't very very large. The idea of this architecture is that you can map those basic blocks with the inputs and outputs. So the inputs and outputs would then be the registers that would be needed by the next building block. The idea then is to map this onto one of those processing elements. Okay, and they more or less communicate directly with each other. So essentially, what you're doing with that design is to get rid of this whole out of order superscalar scheduling that you can see in current designs by simply using the data flow form of the original code, right? And the information then flows directly with more or less point-to-point connections through the different processing elements. So more or less. So this will get very, very interesting since it's not entirely clear how good the compilers are able to extract the information and optimize for such an architecture. So far, there has been some research in that field, but most of the research suggests that different input language, different programming language would be required in order to support such an architecture. But the general idea is that you can have very fine-grained blocks, which are then able to be mapped onto one of those processing elements, such that you naturally get a very high level, high amount of concurrency in one of those chips, right? You can easily, if you have a loop with loop carry dependencies, so dependencies between different loop iterations, right? It's very easy to map this on such a chip, and even have concurrency, concurrent operations, even with those interloop dependencies. So that's the general idea. We'll see when they eventually release more details about the architecture used. Okay. Right. So, yeah. The next point on the agenda is Europe. So it's not clear if Europe will build an exascale system at the time frame of 2021. What the European Commission did, however, is to invest approximately 1 billion euros for the next 3 years to actually advance the hardware building. Okay, but even given that we are able to come up with an exascale design, it's still not very clear who will build it and if it's feasible to build it in terms of financial investment, since Europe doesn't have their own hardware vendor, only system integrator. Okay, and so at the moment, right now, so this whole development is channeled through a organization which is called EuroHPC, which is based in Luxembourg. And at the moment, the current project, at the moment, this organization is trying to determine which architecture is supposed to get into one of those systems. And the most interesting project with respect to that is the Mont Blanc project, which is ongoing since, I think, 10 years now. And they are trying to build a ARM-based supercomputer. They are still in the very early prototype phase. Okay, the other contender in the space is the is a chip based on the RISC-V microarchitecture. The interesting thing, so RISC-V is developed at the University of Berkeley. And the interesting thing here is that it's completely open source. And that means that we can just take the design and advance it and maybe build a high performance chip out of it. Right, but you might see that the quality of the systems that are available is well very different to what's to the systems that are in development in Japan, China, and the US. Right, so it's not entirely clear. So what we saw is that three exascale candidate systems are based on the ARM instruction set. And I just wanted to give the current state here. So there's one system in the top 500, which is based on the Cavium Thunder X2 chip, which is another ARM64 high performance chip. It has 28 cores. The Astra system has two sockets, so in total we have 56 cores in one node of this Astra system. It's currently ranked at position 204 and has a performance of approximately 1.5 petaflops. Okay, and draws power at about 1.2 megawatts. Okay, so the promise of the ARM chips, of the ARM vendors, that we get a very power efficient system just by using ARM doesn't hold yet, right? So we get something at about 1.3 gigaflops per watt, right? 1.25 something gigaflops per watt. And when we look at the current Summit system, we get 40 gigaflops per watt, right? The most energy, the most power efficient system at the moment is at 17 gigaflops per watt. Okay, that's system, also a Japanese system based on the PETSI accelerator. Okay, that concludes the lecture. Thank you for coming. Hope you enjoyed it. We either call it a day now, or we start with the repetition and go through what's relevant for the exam. Whatever you like, we can also do it next time, depending on what you want to do.
Could you briefly give all of you what's relevant to the exam so we can prepare questions regarding those topics for next week?
Okay, so brief overview. There probably won't be lots of questions where you just have to write something down. You have to learn by heart. Okay. Significant part will certainly be about the whole basic computer architecture stuff that we had in the beginning. So you should know the basic principles of von Neumann architecture. Should have a good knowledge about the whole memory hierarchy thing, so cache organization. Should be able to see the difference between CPU architecture and GPU architecture. Should have basic knowledge about the high performance networks, the techniques that are being used there, so user space, RDMA, and what leads to the low latency stuff. You should have a knowledge about the topologies. The roofline model is also important. Don't have to learn which system was at the number one spot at which point in time. Okay, should have a rough idea about which techniques have been used. Okay, so complete homogeneous system, heterogeneous system, where does the trend go to, etc. So the whole development. And that's essentially more or less it, right? So I won't ask you how many compute racks does Summit have, for example, right? Or how many switches.
There could be specific questions about, for example, the Summit.
Probably not. No.
Probably not.
No, and also not about any other of the systems. No. Something that might come up is, for example, why does Summit use a fetch tree topology?
So it's basically, why is the fetch topology good or
But not something like which supercomputer uses Fetri, which supercomputer uses Taurus. That's not something you need to know.
So what do you mean by basic knowledge?
Of the supercomputers? Or
you said to the different topics always you have to have basic knowledge.
That's probably phrased badly. You have to know it. Okay, so basic knowledge in that regard, because the every topic that we discussed
builds up on it,
and basic in the regard that we only touch the surface.
All right.
Okay, so yeah, so we didn't go into detail very much. So basic knowledge in the term that. The information or the topics that we covered is more or less basic stuff. Okay. So yeah, then you can prepare questions for next time.